Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and today my guest for today has recently flown in from across the pond. So he joins us from the lovely UK. And he's a chef, restaurateur, cookbook author, and has recently released a beautiful cookbook that I'm holding in my hands right now called Eat Your Vegetables. We have Arthur Potts Dawson. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for coming.
It's a pleasure. I'm sitting here in a very interesting room, looking out on people eating pizzas and enjoying themselves, and it's making me hungry.
Yeah, because you have a pizza place opening up soon, too.
Opened a pizzeria, yeah, based on the pizzas that I put into the book. You know, uh-huh. Kind of, it's not all vegetarian, but it mainly kind of 90% vegetarian pizza.
Interesting. I mean, that's kind of like the ones that I tend to savor the most, because pizza can be very satisfying on its own, you know? And, right, don't you think?
Well, food... I think there's a lot of different ways of serving food, and some of food can get a little bit stuffy. I spent 25 years cooking, you know, kind of Michelin star food, top end, you know, high end stuff.
Foie gras.
Well, yeah, I kind of gave up on foie gras 5 years ago when I really got a conscience. But, it's a little bit. Sometimes food can be a little bit anal about the way it goes about putting itself on the plate. You know, you have to be very precise. You have to be very, you know, everything has to be the same. But, you know, actually, the past 3 weeks since I've been delivering the business, it's kind of a really, you can be as free as you like.
Yeah.
You know, you just throw it on. Different. You know, you can be really creative, mad flavors, putting in, you know, from, you know, raw carrot at the end of things to, you know, roast lamb pizza. I mean, just, you know, you can just have loads of fun. So I've actually relaxed a little bit in this kind of sort of freestyle pizza mode.
Yeah, so it's like a rustic thing. It's not very composed, you know. I feel like a pizza should be like kind of messy and so forth. And,
well, yeah. I'm kind of approaching the pizzas in, I guess I've grown up a little bit. Like, I've been cooking for 25 years. And, you know, when I was given the chance to write this second cookbook of mine, you know, they kind of said, well, how do you want to do it? Not like this is the original formula. This is how you go about writing a cookbook. They said, how would you do it? So I said, let's set the ideas down. And say, well, look, this is going to be the dish. It's going to be a quinoa salad with, you know, with carrots and radishes and keep it raw.
Like what salad?
Quinoa.
Quinoa.
Quinoa. Okay, quinoa.
Interesting.
Okay.
So, pronunciation difference.
But the fact is, that's the basic idea.
Right.
But I didn't write the recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I cooked the food, took the picture, and then wrote the recipe. So the book actually... is it a direct facsimile of, okay, this picture is that recipe. Not I didn't sit in my office kind of like typing, create the recipe and then go and cook it or have a food stylist cook it.
Right.
I cooked it, they took the picture, then I wrote the recipe associated with the picture. So, you know, the book, you know, if you ever get to have a look at it, it really, the recipe is exactly what it does in the picture.
Wow. So you kind of wrote it in real time.
Yeah.
It was, I hope.
It's kind of a freestyle book. And what's been great about my cooking career is that, the first 10 years was specifically French. The next 10 years was specifically Italian. And inside there's, I've got a great foundation, but I've also got a real kind of freehand approach to cooking. So hopefully that comes across in the book.
Yeah. Well, I am looking at it and it is just absolutely stunning. Every single page has something really amazing. Spinach, mushroom, and ricotta rotolo with sage butter. That is a new one for me.
Well, the rotolo is another way of doing pasta. It's basically a big, flat pasta sheet, you know, nice and thin. You cook your mushrooms, you cook your spinach, you get your ricotta, you can put marjoram, nutmeg, salt and pepper, splash of olive oil, and then you roll it up. It's a bit like a Swiss roll. I don't know if you get Swiss rolls over here, but you kind of roll it up, keep it in a napkin, and poach it in warm water. You don't want it to boil, but you kind of want it about 70, 80 degrees centigrade. It takes about 15 minutes to cook. Pull it out and you cut it like a Swiss roll, but then you kind of serve it with sage butter. Oh, it's so good.
Looks great. Yeah. And you just describe it and it makes a lot more sense, because a lot of these recipes are, I'm really fascinated because they're so practical and they look so simple. Hmm. I love these bean recipes, chickpea stew with broiled onions and smoked paprika, and it just looks stunning. Mm. And that's something I can do, I think.
Well, look, the whole idea there is that's kind of based on the Greek idea. You know where they do those sort of semi-pickled onions? They're sort of a little bit lightly vinegared or lightly lemon juiced.
I think so.
And then kind of either grilled. I know, you have to call it broiled.
Charred, something.
Exactly. Just black on the top. So you get this kind of black, charcoal, lemony, vinegary, kind of crunchy onion with these beautiful kind of braised chickpeas. And, you know, and the paprika gives it that kind of smoky, slight kind of heat to it. Mm. Actually, that's a really good dish.
It looks really good.
The whole book is really good. It kind of makes me hungry looking at it.
So it's mostly vegetarian. That's the idea. Yeah. It's called Eat Your Vegetables, but it's not a strictly vegetarian cookbook. Mm. You're saying it's...
No, look, I mean, you know, I do still have meat in my diet, but the whole idea about incorporating meat into your diet or keeping meat in your diet, it has got to be high quality. You know, you talk about heritage, you know, the heritage breeds in England, you know, whether it's a heritage tomato or a heritage beef, you know, you've got to go good quality. And sometimes... all of the time, if you're going to eat meat, you've got to eat it at the best quality. And it takes time and energy and skill and passion to deliver that high quality meat, which will always equal cost.
Do you think that eating less meat and kind of putting vegetables into the forefront rather than the background of your diet is a trend that is developing or has already been quite underway in the UK? Because here, I've seen that happening slowly but surely.
Yeah, what people don't really realize is that vegetables are in their lives. That they are always consuming potatoes, there's spinach and there's mushrooms, and you know, and they do have vegetables, but they don't consciously pay very much attention to them. Because when I say to you, hey, you want to go out for dinner tonight? Let's go and have a steak.
Yeah.
What we forget is that we'll also have a salad and we'll also have some spinach. There may be some mushrooms on the side. And actually, you know, about 2/3 of the meal is made up of vegetables. There just happens to be a steak on the plate too. And I think that what I'm trying to say with this book is like, look, you know, let's give a little bit more respect to our kind of vegetable cousins and say, look, you know, pay more respect to them, eat them fresh, get them seasonally. And our bodies are designed to consume vegetables as well as meat. And eating vegetables gives you a very good slice of what season you're in.
Yeah.
Like as we're coming up into the autumn now, you're going to get your sweet corn, you're going to get your pumpkins, you're going to get your apples, you're going to get your, you know, all of your want and your honey, all of this wonderful stuff that is particularly seasonal, your body needs. And I think that meat and chicken and, okay, maybe you're going to eat lamb in the spring, but it's kind of available all year round.
Right, right.
And so meat is something that you kind of absorb into your life and it's always there and you don't really think about the season. Vegetables are so much more exciting because you go, wow, it's mushroom season. Oh, you know, it's asparagus season. Mm-hmm. No, it's pea and broad bean season. And so I think that, you know, this book really kind of highlights, look, pay a little bit more attention to your body. Pay a little bit more attention to the season. Each season will deliver you a different vegetable and a different experience. And ultimately, you'll have a hell of a lot of a better time eating and respecting vegetables. And then you can, listen, if you want to eat meat, you can add it. But make sure you, I mean, a lot of people nowadays want to eat meat every day. And without meat in their diet every day, they start to worry. And they start to say, oh, hey, I'm not full up. Well, I think that I eat meat maybe once a week.
Okay.
And fish once a week. The rest of the time, it'll be rice, it'll be a stew, it'll be a soup, it'll be, you know, it can be a risotto, it could be a pasta.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
you get plenty of protein from that.
Exactly.
Stuff.
Yeah. And if you put a really good high quality, I mean, I put an organic, free range, organic
egg.
Chicken into my diet once a week. And eggs too,
egg.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the fact that chicken will cost me nearly £20, which I don't know, was like $30 or something. A $30 chicken. Now, people that I know will go to a supermarket in England and they'll buy two chickens for £5. But they are intensively reared. They're fed with antibiotics. They are, you know, and same with the milk and dairy industry. Why put that stuff into your body every day? It's not doing you any good. And there's diabetes epidemics. There's sugar issues. There's, you know, there's just so many issues associated with food that I think we have to look a little bit at ourselves and say we don't need to consume food in this way anymore. So hopefully this book goes some way to show people, look, change the way you consume meat, have a look at your dairy intake, involve vegetables more in your diet, and you'll be healthier for it.
Absolutely. And it is exciting to see those vegetables change throughout the season. I think that once you keep an eye on that, you can't get bored. Possibly.
No, it's exciting. Yeah. It's exciting.
And, That's a good point.
And part of this book, actually, and I've been I'm going to digress a little bit and we'll come back to this point. In as much that in the publication of the book, prior to the publication, I lived it, ate it, photographed it, wrote it for about 8 months. And in those 8 months, I got so engrossed in it that I didn't really then realize I was actually writing a book. I was just having fun with food.
Right.
And only until the first copy of the book arrived did I actually realize that I'd written a book. I know it sounds a bit strange, but... And then as it got... You know, it's kind of written up really nicely and a lot of people have paid a lot of respect to it. And I've kind of realized, I'm very happy with it. I sort of disregarded it. But a lot of the feedback that came in was the fact that a lot of people didn't really know what to do with so many different varieties of vegetables.
Right.
And I've put in there, I mean, there's nearly 280 recipes, over 70 different varieties of vegetables. And people have said, you know what, now that I can get my vegetable box delivered to me, or I can go down to the farmer's market, or even in the supermarket, I know what to do with that kohlrabi, or that celeriac, or that spinach, or those mushrooms, which I didn't know last week without the book. So it should really inspire people to eat a lot of different vegetables.
It does. I already found an ingredient I've never seen before, samphire.
Oh, yeah, samphire.
It looks cool. It looks kind of like seaweed.
It's seaweed,
God.
Well, no, it grows on the shingle shores of the coast of Britain. You probably get it here. I don't know. Maybe it's in a different word, but samphire is very lightly salty. It's sometimes
umami,
known as sea
right?
asparagus.
Ooh, okay, that's okay.
Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Okay, so and it grows on the shores, on the sort of seashore. And I suggest actually, as foragers that we started out as human beings, we foraged on the seashore before we foraged in the forests. Foraged in the forests.
Mm.
And so it's probably one of our earliest vegetables that we ate.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, along with mussels and lobsters and things
like that. So how did you, Arthur, as a chef for all these French, Michelin-starred restaurants, come to these conclusions about what we, what's great about vegetables in our diet?
Mm.
Right, did you get overweight? Did you?
No. It's funny. I'll give you a restaurant perspective, because a lot of people, if you sit down in a restaurant and you read a menu, you're reading it from a customer point of view. But a chef will not write that menu from a customer's point of view.
Yeah.
He or she will write the menu from a chef's point of view. And the chef's point of view is, how do you structure this menu? How do you then deliver it as quickly as possible, as effectively, cost effectively as possible, as deliciously as possible? All of the things that the chef's taking into perspective to deliver a well-balanced menu. But inside a kitchen, you have different sections. You have the garde-manger, I don't know what you call it here, or the entree section, where you do the salads and the starters. And then you move on to the main course, then you go on to dessert. That's kind of three sections. But usually in a big kitchen, it's about seven.
Except in America, we always have a lot of fry station. No, I'm just kidding.
The fry station.
Yeah.
So the point being is that the foundation of any kitchen is the veg section, or the vegetable section. Because the vegetable section cooks and prepares all the potatoes, cooks and prepares all the vegetables, cooks and prepares... I mean, basically... Two-thirds of the product that comes into the restaurant goes through the veg section. It's heavy, it's bulky, it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of skill. It takes a lot of knowledge to be able to deliver on that veg section. A lot of chefs have this kind of dream of, I want to get to the sauce section where I get to make the perfect gravy for my meal. Then there's the meat section where you cook the steaks and the grouse and the partridge and the pheasant and the, and the lamb and the chicken and all that sort of stuff, and that's usually what people aim at. And then there's the fish section, which is the section kind of underneath the meat section, which is, you're working your way towards meat.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath that is the veg section. And it's kind of like the foundation. It's the cornerstone of the kitchen. And before you can put your partridge on the plate, you need to put the veg on it first.
Yeah.
Before you can put your salmon on the plate, you need to put your veg on it first. So the veg comes forward and says, look, okay, I'm here, now put the chicken on. But I've spent 18 years practically on the veg sections, because every kitchen you go into, to get to the top, you got to go through the veg section.
Oh,
and you usually spend about a year or two on the veg section. And any chef listening to this, you'll know what I mean. The veg section, you got to go through it to get to sauce. So I'm kind of talking code language here for the chefs, but the point is, a lot of chefs spend a lot of time on the veg section, but they're always looking off towards sauce. Actually, what I've always enjoyed and really wanted to get involved with is the veg section is always so interesting because it depends on the season, depends what time of the year you're on that veg section. Is the, oh, it's a mushroom season, oh, it's potato season, oh, it's new potatoes, oh, now it's asparagus, now it's peas. And so it's the most interesting section. Mm-hmm. And so when I thought, well, look, I want to make sure that both the chefs of the world and the customers of the world both get to understand that veg is probably the most important part of a kitchen. Mm-hmm. You just don't know it. So Eat Your Vegetables was like, look, 80 to 90% of the food that comes through your kitchen is vegetable based. You just so happen to put a steak or a piece of chicken or a piece of fish on top of it. So let's stop thinking, oh, let's go out and eat a chicken tonight. So let's go out and eat some vegetables. And if I want to put some protein on it, great, I'll ask them for a bit of chicken. But it's just not important, not as important as vegetables.
That's fascinating. And I mean, looking at the, I love the twisting of the reversing of the hierarchy here and looking at a lot of these vegetable entrees, they look like the star of the dish for sure.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick little interlude, a musical interlude, and we'll be right back and chat about more home cooking and good stuff.
Great.
You're listening to Southern Perimeter by Orlin.
Wake up the children, clear the halls. This is something I've been through before. Not again. If our lives depend on it, so political, analytical, intellectual, ineffectual. Create Southern Pretender, sister, mother, hide your children, hang your jewelry under the pillow, sleep on it, the man in the white shoe.
Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
We're back chatting with Arthur Potts Dawson, the author of Eat Your Vegetables. Wonderful, beautiful cookbook. It just came out. Please get your hands on it. Arthur was just at the New Amsterdam Market yesterday selling a few copies. Actually, I think you sold more than a few copies.
Oh, we sold out. It's kind of a bit embarrassing because people kind of say, why are you here? And I said, well, I was here to sell a book, but we sold them all. So. So they, I just gave people free heritage tomato salad all afternoon. So yeah, it was really good. And you know what? I didn't actually expect, and probably because of my own ignorance, I didn't think there'd be so many foodies over here. And
really?
That it was like foodie heaven. You know.
Well, there's a lot of people here, so you're off to a good start.
No, there are a lot of people here. Yeah, sorry, I've just knocked my pizza all over the place. Hey, by the way, delicious pizza here at Roberta's, without being paid to advertise it.
That's a good compliment coming from a pizzeria restaurateur.
Yeah, well, I'm a new pizzeria owner, okay. Yeah, now, but I'm much more kind of sort of fine food orientated. But you know what? I want to chuck the fine food out the window, okay, and just go freehand.
It sounds like you've had a multitude of projects too. Tell me about the People's Supermarket that was in London.
Yeah, well, one of my visits, I was visiting New York about 5 or 6 years ago. I came across the Park Slope Food Co-op, and in my quest to try and make the world a greener, more sustainable place, I was opening restaurants in London, which were, you know, reducing the impact of waste, of energy consumption, of product consumption. I was composting. I was doing wormeries. I was doing...
So self-contained, like, green restaurants?
Yeah, it was green restaurants. Yeah, cool. And that's kind of what I'm known for over in London. And the issue with that is it's all very well that you're doing that, but how much of an impact are you having on the planet? Because all I was really doing was attracting the same like-minded people. Mm-hmm. So if you'd be lucky if about 5% of the population pays any attention to the way that you want to have, you know, organic dairy, organic
meat. Restaurant run.
Yeah, restaurant run, all that. So all I had was people turning up, patting me on the back, saying, hey, well, I'm green too, let's be green together. And I was just like, well, actually, I want to know what the 95% of people are doing, because 5% isn't enough for me. So I kind of knew that to try and get the green message across, or certainly the message of how to do business differently, I had to do something that people used every single day, and that was a supermarket. So I kind of took the lead from Joe Holtz and his team at the Park Slope Food Co-op and said, look, I want to come over here, take your business model, bring it back to London, open up something, and I called it the People's Supermarket. So if you like, Google the People's Supermarket, and you can have a really good look at what it is we've achieved in the past 4 years. And inside the People's Supermarket, I created something called the People's Kitchen. And supermarkets in England generate a vast amount of waste, especially from their fresh fruit and vegetables. It's about 30% of the fruit and vegetable comes in, goes out as waste. So at the People's Supermarket, I created the People's Kitchen, which absorbed all of the waste generated by the supermarket and turned it into another product that you then bought at about half the price of a normal quiche or a pasta salad or a soup or whatever. And so the People's Kitchen has been the biggest success.
Wow.
And, you know, so it's managing food waste at a supermarket level, which is mega.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got about 3,000 square feet of sales floor, which isn't very much.
Maybe we should do that at the Park Slope Food Co-op.
Well, I'm going to see Joe later on today, so I want to tell him, listen, come and let me do the People's Kitchen over here.
So it's like a prepared food section.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, okay. But it's live. It's going out fresh every day. And, you know, people can come and interact. People come and volunteer their time. And actually, the great thing about the People's Kitchen was that you have to volunteer your time into the People's Supermarket, just like at the Park Slope Food Co-op, where the time you give, you get money back off at your at the till end. You know, so when you're buying it, you get your money off. Exactly the same model at the People's Supermarket, but you know, you could really make a decision as to where you wanted to work. So I actually ended up having hundreds of people wanting to come and work in the People's Kitchen, because they'd learned not only how to deal with food waste at a house level thing, but they also learned something. So they learned
exactly
how to make
it. Exactly, and that's the whole idea of the co-op, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you're
sharing information.
Everybody is working for. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that did really, really well. So yeah, well, you know, I've been pretty active, I suppose, and you know, the People's Kitchen is just a fantastic idea, and it's one that's going to carry on forever. And then since then, I've done something called thecrystal.org, which is a 400 solar panel rooftop kind of, you know, absorbing energy, which you can power your car off, and black water treatment facility, and it's become London's urban sustainability center.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was delivering that, I've been doing brown paper pizzas. Brown paper pizzas is my newest venture, which is all about sustainable fast food. And you know, it's all about the concept of the carbon cycle. My first restaurant, Acorn House, was based on the element of wood, which is all about education. The second restaurant I did was called Waterhouse, which is all about the element of water.
Nice.
which is element is education and wisdom. So everything I learned from delivering Acorn House, I put into Waterhouse and went further. So the third concept is the fire element, and that's all about the carbon cycle. So I'm using brown paper as my placemat, as my napkin, as my receipt, as my menu, and all of that is then composted through my, you know, through the land around the restaurant.
Great.
Which is all about carbon sequestration. So if anyone out there who deals with carbon sequestration wants to talk about, you know, how to go about it, or you could tell me more about it, that'd be really helpful. It's basically trying to lock carbon back into the system, into the ground.
Right,
because at the moment, we're burning it, you know, into the atmosphere at such a pace that I don't know where we're going to be in 10 years' time. So really, I wanted to try and say that fast food needs to grow up. It needs to actually start to take account for itself, because at the moment, it's doing a serious amount of damage to this planet.
So you're taking responsibility for all that with the paper napkins and everything, and just dealing with that waste
and
yourself.
Upcycling, and upcycling. Yeah. Rather than recycling, which I don't agree with, I think recycling is just another form of energy requirement, and then it will ultimately end up in landfill. It's all about upcycling. So I'll take the old menu and I'll roll it up, and I'll roll up all my old menus, and I put them together with hair clips, and it creates a heat pad, which I can put my mocha coffee on top of. So I serve mocha coffee. I don't do the, you know, the big espresso machine anymore. I just do these little Italian mocha thing. You open it up, put the coffee inside, and then it percolates through over a heat. Delicious coffee, single estate Ethiopian Yerkechefe coffee. So lots of little kind of quirky things that I've built into the business, which actually highlight independent traders, highlights, you know, the carbon cycle. Because it's very difficult to tell people what the carbon cycle actually is. They don't get it. And like the second restaurant I did was the Waterhouse. It was all about the water cycle and how water, you know, comes up, precipitates down as rain, goes through the seas and back through the rivers. And then they go, well, I don't get it. Well, what is water? Where does it come from? So, you know, and so this time I'm now trying to do carbon. And again, the carbon cycle, people just don't get. So I think it's kind of, how do you spread the message, you know?
Well, a good way to start is by sharing some or serving some really great food to go along with the discussion or learning experience.
Food is one, you know, food is probably the only thing that really pulls groups of people together. Mm-hmm. You know, at weddings and funerals or whatever, it's always about food. So, you know, communication, I think food is a wonderful way of getting people to communicate.
Right.
And, you know, it's a bit like a priest, I suppose. It marries people together. Right. You know, food is an important part of our lives. And I was talking to someone yesterday about how too many people consider food to be an inconvenience. You know, oh man, it's lunchtime, I've got to eat something really quickly, and then I've got to go back to work. Actually, come on, take a little time out, enjoy your food, respect your food a little bit more, and you'll respect your body a little bit more, which should ultimately let you respect the planet a bit more.
Right. I can't relate with that, though. I do see those ads on the subway like, hey, just take this bar with you and you'll be
done.
Bar,
yeah, sure.
So I ask this question to every guest. What makes the ultimate date meal, in your opinion?
Ooh. It depends if I'm cooking
it. A date-worthy meal. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It all depends on... I guess there's a lot of points of depending on here. If it's a first... Is it a first date?
It could be. Or just, you know, your ideal, whatever, situation, scenario.
Okay. So, okay. Well, then, my ideal meal to actually get the kind of aphrodisiac juices flowing, and one that never really fails.
Okay.
So hopefully you can try
Please,
this.
Yeah.
You've always got to start with asparagus. And usually, actually, there's a recipe in there where I do roasted asparagus with cherry tomatoes, a tiny splash of balsamic vinegar, and literally just roast that through the oven. And that should start.
High temp, like 450, and then just
get it high, roast it, for about 8-9 minutes. Keep the asparagus just al dente, you know, just to the bite, and the cherry tomatoes will give you, and then maybe put a little splash of balsamic vinegar on it. That's nice and simple. But asparagus is an unbelievable aphrodisiac.
Do I have to wait till the spring to have this date?
Okay, you have
fine.
To wait
okay,
to find your
cool.
husband in the spring.
It's a good time for a date anyway.
And then, main course needs to be a Dover sole. Now, I'm not quite sure if you get Dover sole over here. But
Graysole, same thing? I don't know.
No, Dover, I suppose, is actually...
I'll look into it.
Yeah, Dover sole. Okay. Or turbot.
Turbot.
So turbot, what it is it's a big meaty fish.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of, you know, it's got a lot of energy in it. And so, you know, that kind of gets the juices flowing as well. I usually serve that with our new potatoes or roast potatoes. Either, you know, the chopped rosemary or, you know, sort of basil and mint sauce with that.
How do you cook the fish?
You've got to keep it
whole?
On the bone.
Okay.
Keep it on the bone. Well, it depends how big your turbot is. But usually if you go to a fishmonger, he'll be serving it in a tranche, like in a slice with the bone through it.
Okay.
Filleted, you know, you got to get some bone into your date meal, you know. It's important.
Good.
You know, it gives you full power. And then, you know, you got to go chocolate as dessert. I mean, chocolate with cherries, chocolate with strawberries. It depends if you love your date or not. Strawberries for love, cherries for passion. Or maybe you should do strawberries and cherries, and then you get this kind of love passion thing going on.
Gosh, maybe I was doing the wrong berry there. For now, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I'll have to try that out. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much a guaranteed date meal.
Okay.
Yeah, I've cooked it a lot of times.
Really?
I've been on a lot of dates.
I want to go. I want to get some turbo, yeah. turbot, whatever.
Yeah.
Really soon. But thanks so much for the advice and the inspiring stories about your restaurants. I wish you the best of luck with the new one
and
future projects that I'm sure you'll be doing next.
Great.
On different elements.
Oh, you got to have me back. Next time I'm in New York, please have me back on.
Please, yes, definitely.
Okay. I'm sure I'll be doing some crazy project.
And congrats on the new book. Do check it out. Eat Your Vegetables. It just came out from Octopus Publishing this August. And thanks to everyone at Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week on Let's Eat In.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.